the fall. If you don't have a Bible and you'd like to follow along, that'd be great. There are a number of Bibles at the table in the back. Feel free to borrow one during the service. If you don't have a Bible at all, you're welcome to take one of those. That'd be our gift to you. So invite you to open to the book of Hebrews chapter 11. Want to show you something, and I'm going to ask for someone to help me here in a moment, if I can dig it out of my pocket. Steve, just because this will bless your heart, I'm wondering if you can look at that and tell everyone what that is.
That is the ring where the Leafs won the Stanley Cup.
It is a Toronto Maple Leafs Stanley Cup ring from 1932. The Leafs won the Stanley Cup in 1932. It was their first Stanley Cup victory. I've been waiting for a long time, not since 32. They've won since then. But that's their first. They swept the Rangers in a five-game series, three straight games. I received this as a gift not long ago, and I had it set out on a shelf in my office. My boys hadn't seen it, at least Nathaniel hadn't, and he came into the den while I was there working at the desk, and he saw it, and he said, "Dad, what's this? It's a Leaf Stanley Cup ring." I didn't look. I didn't turn around to look, but I could tell he was like really curious about this. And he said, "How much is it worth?" And without thinking, I just said, $3,500. And I could feel his eyes bug out behind me. Just like. Now, Brennan was also in the room, and Brennan knew that his friend had given it to me and that it's a cheap imitation. And so quickly, I set the record straight. Brennan's friend's father had gone to Toronto recently, had visited the Hockey Hall of Fame. I don't know if any of you have been there. I grew up in the area, and I went there a number of times as a child. The Hockey Hall of Fame is sort of this mecca with memories of the greats of hockey, the history of the NHL. And I remember as a kid, the thing that stands out largest in my memory is seeing the Stanley Cup there in its case and seeing it up close and personal. It's a great place to go if you are a fan of hockey. If you want to reminisce about the history, the greats, and all that's gone on. If I, as a Toronto Maple Leaf fan, want to remember the glory years when they were winning the Stanley Cup back in 32 and a few other times. This morning we're coming to Hebrews chapter 11, a chapter of Scripture that is often referred to as the Hall of Faith. It is a chapter that recounts and points to, reminds us of men and women in the story of God's people, men and women who had faith in God. And so it's called the Hall of Faith, if you will, often referred to that way. Now, truth be told, chapter 11, these 40 verses, there is a lot here. We could camp out here for weeks. In fact, it'd be a lot of fun and I think rich to walk through here slowly. I counted up there. Points to 20 different individuals or groups of people who demonstrated faith in God. And I thought, we could easily turn this into a 20-week sermon series, just this chapter. Don't worry, we won't do that. I'm going to attempt something else this morning. Maybe we'll come back to it some other year. But this morning, what I want to do is try and walk through the entire chapter together as a whole. And so we're going to kind of cruise over it at bird's eye view and then just dive down at some key points to unpack a number of important details this morning. Remember, this book, this letter, Hebrews, was written by a pastor to a group of Christians whom he knew. They knew him, he knew them. They are beginning to face increasing opposition, persecution, and now even the threat of death. And in the face of that, they are contemplating, some of them are considering turning away from Jesus and returning to their roots in Judaism. Because at this point in time in the Roman Empire, it was legal to be practice Judaism, but Christianity was becoming more and more under attack. And so the author of Hebrews is writing to these believers to encourage them to hold on to Jesus in the face of whatever comes. Because a return to Judaism is a return to nothing. All of the Old Covenant, the whole Old Testament, everything that has come before has been pointing to Jesus, has been fulfilled in Jesus. And so if they walk away from Jesus, they walk away from everything and will find themselves under God's judgment as God's enemies. And so with great passion throughout this letter, he's been imploring them to hold on to Jesus. That's the whole, if you were to sum up Hebrews, I hope you can all know that when we get to the end of this book, you can tell anyone, this is what Hebrews is about, holding on to Jesus no matter what you face. That's the point. That's why the author's written this. So I want to turn to the text. It's fairly lengthy, but just want to read through Hebrews 11, verses 1 to 40 this morning. Now, faith is confidence in what we hope for, an assurance about what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. By faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offerings. And by faith, Abel still speaks even though he is dead. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. By faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that is in keeping with faith. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land, like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And by faith, even Sarah, who was past childbearing age, was enabled to bear children because she considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this one man, and he as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had the opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead, and so in a manner of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions concerning the burial of his bones. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he'd grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the application of blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land, but when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after the army had marched around them for 7 days. By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. And what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, and Jephthah, about David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. There were others who were tortured, refusing to be released so that they might gain an even better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawed in two. They were killed by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, living in caves and in holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised, since God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. There's a lot there. Wouldn't take long to unpack that over 20 weeks, but we're going to try to hit a few key points this morning in the time we have together. I want to do four things with you. First, I want to provide you with an explanation of faith. What exactly is faith? What exactly is the author of Hebrews speaking about throughout this chapter? Second, I want to lead you through briefly through these examples of faith, making a few brief comments. Third, I want to unpack for you the effects or the impact of faith on the lives of the people of God. And then fourth, I want to do as the author of Hebrews is attempting to do for his original listeners. That is, I want to encourage you and I to be persons of faith, men and women of faith, as are these individuals. So first, an explanation of faith. What is faith? How are we to understand this word that, quite frankly, we often toss around within the church, often without maybe thinking about it too deeply? What exactly does the author of Hebrews mean when he speaks of faith? Well, verse 1, he speaks about it. He says, now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. Let's try to unpack that. Faith, according to the author of Hebrews, is not simply hoping for something to happen. It is not simply wishful thinking, though it is related to the idea of hope. I want to just invite you to think through something with me, and we won't talk about hockey all morning, but a number of weeks ago, the NHL had their entry draft. And as a Leaf fan, I was really hoping that the Maple Leafs would get that first draft pick. I didn't have a lot of confidence that it would happen. They had a 9.5% chance of doing it, but the Oilers were in the mix too, and they always win the first draft pick. So I didn't have a lot of confidence. I was hoping, I was wishing for, but I didn't go out and buy a new Leaf sweater and have McDavid's name and number sewn on the back because I didn't have confidence that it would happen. It was possible. The author of Hebrews is defining hope and saying this is not wishful thinking. This is about rock-solid confidence in what you hope for. The idea is that there is substance to what one is hoping for. There is an objective reality to it, not because the thing hoped for has already happened, not because it is already here, but because it is promised by God, and God's promises are utterly reliable. And so this hoping for is not wishful thinking. There is a knowing, there is a substance, there is something solid to this. It is a sure thing, a certainty. The second phrase that he uses, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. The assurance about what we do not see speaks about the certainty of faith in two regards. First, that is with regards to the invisible realm, if you will, that which is not perceptible to us with our physical eyes. There is a reality all around us, even right now, that we cannot see. In the book of book of Revelation, we see this often. The book of Revelation, God gives John a vision. It's as if he pulls back the veil, he pulls back the curtain and says, John, look, this is what's really going on. There is more going on than you see with your physical eyes. He gives him a vision of the invisible realm. And so this assurance about what we do not see speaks to that, but also, secondly, it speaks to what yet lies in the future. What yet lies in the future we cannot see because it lays in front of us, but because God has ordained that future, it is absolutely certain. Though we don't perceive it with our physical eyes, it is good. We can count on it. It's as good as done. Faith is, therefore, it is a view of reality that says God's God will absolutely do all that he has promised. It is a view of reality that says there is more going on even in this moment than my physical eyes can see. It is a view of reality that says the future is not in question because the one who holds the future has promised and he will fulfill his promises. That is faith. That is a perspective of life, a way to understand and to live life with that faith, knowing and trusting God in all that he has said. That faith, when we have it, it regulates all of life in the present, in the face of what we do currently see. And one lives not simply in light of what one sees and what is currently happening, but one can live rather in light of what knows is coming and in light of what has been promised by God. And that is faith, and that is what the ancients, verse 2, were commended for. Living their lives in light of what God had promised, living their lives in light of the unseen realm and what God told them, living in light of God's trustworthiness. And it's at that point, having defined faith in that way, that the author of Hebrews leads us into this long recounting of this catalog of Israel's history. It begins in verse 3. Before he begins, let's look at these examples of faith. Before he begins to celebrate the faith of the ancients, he first of all draws in his listeners. Remember, he's writing to believers who are struggling, who are facing suffering and opposition, who are contemplating turning away from Jesus. And so he begins by really identifying himself with them and identifying themselves as a group with all those that he's about to talk about. He says in verse 3, by faith we, you, my original listeners, and myself, he says, we understand that that the universe was formed at God's command. Though we did not see God create, he says, we understand, we have faith that God is the creator God, that all that we do see has been made by him. And so he's connecting his listeners with all those who will follow. And then he turns to the very beginning of the biblical story, to Adam and Eve's son Abel. He begins there, and again, here we're going to breeze through this history, walking through the biblical story. But he says, first, by faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. Why was his gift better? Well, a number of things could be said, but above all, in this context, I'll say because he offered it in faith. We know a few verses later, one cannot please God apart from faith, and Cain's gift did not please God. Abel's did. He gave it by faith. Next comes Enoch, a man who walked with God, a man who pleased God. He didn't die. God took him directly to heaven. Why? Because he was a man of faith. He pleased God. It's impossible to please God without faith. Moving forward in the story, we encounter Noah, who took God at his word, who heeded his warning, and he built an ark in the middle of dry land. Next, Abraham and Sarah, the patriarch and matriarch of Israel. Abraham was told to pick up and move to a place he did not know, and he obeyed God, trusting that God would fulfill his promise, that one day his descendants would inherit the promised land. Sarah, though she was past the age of children, gave birth to a child, and Abraham believed, they had faith in God. By faith, Abraham offered Isaac as a sacrifice. Remember that story? God says to Abraham to take Isaac, his one and only son, the one through whom God said your descendants would be counted. Through Isaac, take that one son and sacrifice him as a burnt offering to me on Mount Moriah. And Abraham, in faith, believes God. The author of Hebrews says he believed that God could raise the dead. And so he went to offer Isaac. And we know the story. God stopped him from sacrificing him at the last moment. And the author of Hebrews says, in a sense, God gave Isaac back to him from the dead. By faith, he trusted God. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regards to concerning things to come, things that lay in the future, things they could not see. By faith, Jacob blessed the sons of Joseph. And Joseph, by faith, gave instructions to his descendants to take his bones to the promised land one day when God would honor that promise. By faith, a Hebrew couple defied the edict of the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, and they hid their son Moses for months, for 3 months. By faith, Moses chose to identify himself not as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, but as an Israelite, and he faced mistreatment rather than enjoying the fleeting pleasures of sin for a season. By faith, God's people passed through the Red Sea on dry ground. Imagine walking through this hallway, through the sea, walls of water, you know, the odd fish swimming by. I mean, I don't know what. By faith, they crossed the Red Sea. God's people did that. By faith, the Hebrews marched around Jericho 7 days. What kind of military strategy is that? By faith, the prostitute Rahab protected the Hebrew spies and her life was saved. And at this point in recounting Israel's history, just taking us through the biblical story, the author is just, he lists a whole bunch of other individuals, groups who demonstrated faith in God. And here's why I say we could go back and walk through each of the stories about each of these people, each of these events, and unpack it in greater detail. But he points to all these individuals who trusted God: Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, the prophets. And this list that he gives us through the book of Hebrews, the list that he provides for his original readers, is not an exhaustive list. It is representative. He carries them through the biblical story from Adam and Eve's son Abel to the prophets. He leads them through that and just shows how there were men and women, how the people of God demonstrated faith in God. And the author of Hebrews has been imploring the Hebrews, his listeners, to be men and women of faith, men and women who will trust God. And so he's reminding them of those who've gone before them, of those who have faced the unknown, of those who have faced the impossible, those who have faced difficulty and suffering and challenges, and they've done so with faith. They have trusted God. And so there can be great comfort in knowing that others have gone before him, that others have gone before them, that you are not alone in what you're doing. I remember as a child, the very first time I rode a looping roller coaster, I remember clearly standing in line and being pretty nervous, but I thought, I can do this. And I remember standing there, I don't know if you have the same kind of logic, but I stood there and I would watch people coming off and I would just say to myself, most of them are smiling and they're all alive. Most of them are smiling and they're all alive. Most of them are smiling and they're all alive. I could look at their example and get some courage. Okay, I can do this. I can do this. There is this sense of hope and courage that can rise up when we see others who've gone before us. And the author of Hebrews, wanting to implore, he's argued for all the reasons why his listeners should trust God in the face of the opposition, in the face of the persecution, even in the face of the threat of martyrdom. And now he's saying, look, others have gone before you. Others have trusted God. Others have had faith in God. You are not alone. So let's turn from those examples of faith and look at the effects of faith or the impact of faith. And there are three things that I want to highlight this morning. Being a man or a woman of faith, trusting in God will have profound effect on your life, on my life. Faith makes a difference. Let me identify three. First, faith means that you and I live as strangers in this world. It means that we will live as foreigners because our faith means that we believe what God has promised. We believe what God says. And God tells us that this life is not simply about this life, that there is a larger story that we're a part of, that there is a promised future. Remember earlier in Hebrews, he spoke about a Sabbath rest to come. That is, there is a promised land that we will yet enter. There is heaven to be gained. And so we live as foreigners. We live as strangers. And that impacts how we live our life day to day. That means that our attachment to this world, we need to hold things loosely. That is, we don't need to hold on to things so tightly. We don't need to pursue the things of this world as if that's the end goal, because it's not the end goal. The end goal is to live as part of God's story. The end goal is to honor Jesus, to obey Jesus, to live for His coming kingdom. And that inevitably will impact how we live our lives. It will shape everything. It will shape how we approach work. It will shape how we approach money. It will shape how we approach everything. We will seek to be engage in relationships with people so that we can point them to Jesus, because Jesus is our only hope. He is the only hope for a lost and dying world. And so we are not men and women, I've said this before, we don't simply put our faith in Jesus so that one day when we die, we'll go to heaven. No, we put our faith in Jesus and He begins to transform us, and we begin living the life of the future now. We begin to live now in light of that future, of God's greater story. And so we live as foreigners, as strangers, part of the larger story. Second thing, when we live with faith, we recognize that God can and may call us to do great things for Him. Look at verses 33 to 34 of our text. Speaking of these individuals that he just listed off, he says this about them. These people who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Remember, this isn't exhaustive, but we can start thinking of Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and just all these Old Testament stories of individuals who had faith in God. We're reminded of that, and we see that through them, great things were accomplished. Great things were done. Kingdoms were conquered. Mouths of lions were shut. Quenched the flames. Escaped the edge of the sword. And it was by faith in God. Notice, it wasn't by their strength. It wasn't by their greatness. Remember, it says that by their faith, their weakness was turned to strength. What you and I need to realize is that as men and women of faith, as men and women who put our faith in Jesus, we are not living, you are not living your own little story. I don't want to shatter any dreams here. Well, maybe I do. You're not living your own little story. You are living as part of God's greater story. And God's greater story is worth living for. It's worth giving your all for. And so God has invited you. He's invited me. He's called us into that story. And God wants to use us to accomplish His kingdom purposes. And so through us, He can change our weakness into strength. God can use us to accomplish great things for Him. And what He calls us to do, He will empower us to do. And so none of us live our own little lives. We are empowered by the Spirit of God who indwells us. And we are living as part of this greater drama, this greater narrative. And God is bringing it to fulfillment. God's purposes will be fulfilled, and so we can live into that, whatever He calls us to, with great confidence and courage. There's a third thing that we see in our text, and that is that we may not only accomplish great things for God, but we may suffer great things for God. Quite frankly, if you give me a choice, I'd rather accomplish great things for God than suffer great things for God. But this is really important to catch, because often in the church, we've miscommunicated to people. Often in the church, we've believed things that are not true. We think of God often, I call it vending machine kind of God theology. We think that if we give our life to God, if we put our loony in, you know, we pray and we show up at church and we live a mostly morally good life, then God will give us the candy bar. He'll give us what we want. But that's to think wrongly. Having faith in God does not mean that all will go well. I remember years ago, about 9 years ago, I had the chance to go to Northern Africa, into a closed country. And I remember before I left, I don't remember how old Calvin would have been, our oldest at the time. I remember overhearing him ask Christine in the other room, could Daddy die on this trip? What did that do to my heart? And the truth is, believing in God, trusting God, didn't mean that the answer was no, he couldn't. We really don't know. The truth is, as we read this text about men and women who had faith in God, look what we read in verses 35 and following. Verse 35 in the middle. There were others who were tortured, refusing to be released so that they might gain an even better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawed in two. They were killed by the sword. Faith in God does not mean that we will live a pain-free life where we don't suffer. There are those who have trusted God who have died horrible deaths. That reference to being sawed in two likely is a reference to the prophet Isaiah, called by God to be his spokesman, cut in two. These are men and women, people who have trusted God, who have believed God, who have lived with faith, and they have suffered greatly. And we need to grasp that. We need to grasp that as the people of God, that trusting God, having faith in God, does not mean that life will be pain-free and rosy and all that we long for, all that we hope for. In fact, our hopes need to be changed so that our hopes are related to God's larger story, that we care more about His glory than our comfort, that we care more about the advance of His kingdom than we do about getting the things in this life that we want. We need to let go of those attachments and realize that following God, that being men and women of faith, may mean that we will be called to suffer great things for God. But that we can do that with courage and confidence because God is a God who rewards us. God is a God who will bless us beyond our wildest imaginations. That Paul says that the glory awaits us makes our troubles now, the things that we suffer, the glory to come outweighs our light and momentary troubles, he says. In Paul, you read his lists of all the things he suffered. He suffered greatly. But there is a reward to come. There are blessings and glory that we will experience as God's people that far outweigh anything we could ever suffer. On that issue of reward, I just reminded of a story. Some of you will have heard this. A number of years ago, our family was at a family retreat in BC, and there was a high ropes course there, and Brennan, I think he was about 5 or 6 at the time. He managed to make it through this high ropes course. He was pretty scared, pretty nervous, but he made it through right till the end. The end was this platform and a zip line, and it probably looked like it went on for miles. It was like 3,000 feet up. And he was sitting there on that, it was about 20 feet up. He was sitting on that platform and holding onto the rope. He was all strapped in, buckled in, but he would not jump. And for probably 20 minutes, I was down below saying, "You can do this. You'll be okay. Others have done it. You know, most of them are smiling and they're all alive." I didn't say that. But he just sat there and he wouldn't move. I couldn't do it. And I thought, "Oh, you're going to be disappointed later. You so want to do this. You'll be so happy you did it." And nothing would work. I wanted to encourage him. And then finally, in a moment of, I don't know, insanity or whatever, I just said, "Brennan, you do this. I'll buy you 12 donuts." He got up and jumped like that. Didn't even stop to think. It was just like split second, and he was winging down that wire. And at the bottom, he was just like, "Donuts, 12 of them." I mean, he's 6. What are you going to do with 12 donuts? But there was this promised reward, and for him in that moment, it was enough. He could overcome whatever. God has promised a reward, a city that he is building, a glory that far outweighs anything we may suffer. So the fourth thing I wanted to do is encourage you and myself to be men and women who live lives of faith. As we survey this history, this catalog of those in Israel's story, and the story of God's people who lived with faith, through whom God did great things, those whom suffered great things for God, I want to note this for you, because we think about the Hall of Faith, right? The title that is given to this chapter, and we think of those who are great, those who are beyond us. I walked through the Hockey Hall of Fame, and the truth is, you know, put me on skates and give me a stick, I cannot compete with anyone in that hockey. I mean, I can't compete with most anyone. I never grew up playing ice hockey. I can skate. I remember thinking a number of years ago, I taught my boys to skate in backyard rinks, and I thought, yeah, I'm getting pretty good at this. And then I was invited to go play pickup hockey with a number of guys from the church at the time who grew up playing hockey, and I realized I'm little more than a pylon. And we can be overwhelmed. We read this list of people and we go, wow, these were great men and women of faith. But the truth is, when we look a little closer, we can recognize, it's glaringly true that these heroes of faith didn't have it all together. Noah was a drunkard. Abraham, twice, He lied that his wife was just his sister because he was scared for his own skin. Jacob was a deceiver. Joseph was a cocky, tactless teenager. Rahab was a prostitute. She slept with men for money. Gideon was a complete chicken. God told him to do something. He said, God, did you really say that? Make this thing dry. Okay, God, make this thing wet. God, really? Are you saying this really? Gideon is listed in the hall of faith. Are you kidding? See, the reality is, we read through this list of these men and women, these individuals, and it is not that they are such amazing men and women of faith. It is that their faith was in God who is reliable, in God who is great. They believed Him. They trusted in Him. They believed His promises. They believed that He was moving in history to an appointed end, and consequently, they could face whatever may come with boldness, with courage, with hope, not because of their greatness, but because of His greatness. Being a man or a woman of faith is about trusting in a great God. It's not about figuring it all out on your own and somehow mustering up the strength. It's trusting in Him. It's living in light of who He is and what He's promised and what He's doing. And here's where we desperately need to hear and be reminded of the good news. Being a woman of faith, being a man of faith, is believing God's word. It's believing what God has said. It's believing the good news, the gospel that has been effected and announced by Jesus, that through faith in Christ, we are forgiven for our sin, all of it. The penalty has been paid, that through faith in Christ, we are clothed with Christ's perfect righteousness. It's not about you and I cleaning ourselves up, pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. It's about us resting in the righteousness of Christ. We are clothed with His righteousness. We are secure. We are adopted as His children. We are empowered by His Spirit living in us. It is all about Him. It is about His greatness, not ours. And so, what does that mean for us if we are to be men and women whose lives are regulated, shaped by, transformed by faith? It means we need to look forward. It means we need to fix our eyes on Christ. It means we need to fix our eyes on His promises. It means we need to fix our eyes on how the story ends, and through His word, we know how it ends. And it's not up for grabs. It's not maybe. It's not wishful thinking. We can, with confidence and assurance, look forward to that day and live in light of it. Live as if it's already happened. It was already true. Edmonton is Festival City. I don't know how many festivals you go to. There's a couple that we love. Heritage Festival's awesome. Great food. One of our favorites is the Street Performance Festival. If you've ever gone, there's lots of fun performances and acts that go on there. And there's one that I remember last year, and it probably happens every year. They always call on volunteers and usually embarrass them in some way. This one, they just freaked out this poor young woman. I think almost all of them juggle. These two guys had this volunteer stand between them, and then they started hucking, I think, bowling pins or something. Kind of one behind her, one in front of her, right? And these things are flying, and she's told to stand there and look forward as they do this in front and behind her. If you follow. And in that moment, she's not looking around. She's not looking to the left or right to check things. She's just got her eyes forward. They said, don't move, and she didn't. And those things are flying really close. That's the picture I want to leave with you. To be men and women of faith is to not be looking left or right, not to become attached to the things of this world. It is to stare into the face of Jesus. To stare at the promises that lie before us, the promise of reward, the promise of a great city, the promise of restoration, that one day God will set all things right. He will dry every tear. He will take away our sin once and for all. We will be made perfect. We will experience life in His presence as it was meant to be. No more pain, no more death, no more tears. We need to be men and women who fix our eyes on God and trust in Him. It's about His greatness. We need only to look to Him and put our faith in Him. Amen.